I'm going to describe a study which was a secondary analysis that we did from data in the from the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs. And I would like to acknowledge my colleagues at the University of Washington in Seattle, Janice Bell and Donald Patrick, in working on this analysis. I don't have any relationships to disclose. In this session, I would like to have you become aware of the healthcare transition issues facing youth with mobility limitation, to gain an understanding of the associations between mobility limitation and measures of transition planning, and also to describe specific components of medical home that are associated with transition planning. A little bit of a background. Healthcare transition from pediatric to adult care is becoming more and more of an issue as more young people with chronic illness and disability are moving into adulthood, and also as the healthcare delivery systems are becoming more complex. And it'll be interesting to see some of the changes that occur with health insurance reform. Many young adults with special health care needs know little about healthcare transition, and more than one half feel that they're not prepared when they transfer to adult care. In a separate analysis that we did, we found that in the 2007 National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs, 28% of youth with mobility limitation ages 0 to 17 had a medical home, compared with 47% of youth with all other special health care needs. So even compared to other children with other special health care needs, children with mobility limitation are less likely to, their parents are less likely to report that the care they're receiving meets criteria for medical home, which I'll describe. The reason we did this analysis was that we couldn't find any studies in which that looked at the issue of medical home and how it's associated with healthcare transition planning. So the study objectives were to test the associations between mobility limitation and transition planning, including receipt of healthcare advice from providers, and to look at different components of medical home and how they're associated with that planning. The data source was the 2005-2006 National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs. We included only youth ages 12 to 17. Sort of debated in terms of the lower end of that, whether where we wanted that to be, but we decided to go with more of a liberal band to get a sense for when transition advice is coming into play. And these were youth who were only receiving their health care only from pediatric providers, and that was because we were interested specifically in looking at the transition from pediatric care to adult care. The sample size was 18,179. So in the study variables, in the National Survey of Special Health Care Needs, and again, everything here is parent report. Mobility limitation is defined in accordance with the World Health Organization International Classification of Functioning, which is concerned with restrictions in function and activity rather than specific diagnostic categories. And you can see the actual question which the parents answered. It was, compared to other children of the same age, does the child experience difficulty with coordination or moving around, such as walking or running? And this includes congenital conditions, such as spina bifida, disease-related impairments, and all other causes. The medical home variable it's very complex the way it's defined. There's an algorithm which is based on, as far as I can tell, 30-some questions. But the major components which go into this definition are, is there a personal doctor or nurse? Is there a usual source of care, which is just in general, is there a usual place they go, whereas a personal doctor or nurse is a separate issue. You can have a usual source of care and still not have a personal doctor or nurse. Is it accessible, family-centered, and coordinated? And I have, if I have time, I have a couple of slides which shows the full range of items that go into defining these components. The transition planning and advice variables, there were two separate variables that we looked at. One was just an overall transition planning variable, and that was whether the youth met criteria for receiving services necessary for making the transition to all aspects of adult life, including healthcare, work, and independence. And then we looked specifically at healthcare transition advice received. And that was four different types of advice, and it was discussing the shift to an adult provider, discussing future healthcare needs, discussing future health insurance needs, and the provider encouraging the youth to engage in age-appropriate self-care. We basically controlled for everything that we thought could confound the relationship. So as you can see, sex, age, race, ethnicity, census region, family structure, family income as percentage of the federal poverty line, their health insurance status, highest education of anyone in the household, again, parent-reported report of the youth's condition severity, prescription drug use, and school absences during the prior year. This was a cross-sectional analysis with logistic regression controlling for covariates with and without medical home, and stratified by mobility limitation. So we can see some of the characteristics of the sample here. The main things I think to point out are when you look at the first column here, the mobility limitation versus all other special health care needs, there's a couple little differences here, but given this large sample size, there isn't, in terms of race ethnicity, nothing really pops out. But when you get to insurance, looking at private insurance, youth with mobility limitations, 48% report their parents report having access to private insurance, compared to 67% of those with all their special health care needs. And then just flipped in terms of the public, more likely to have public insurance than the rest of the sample. The families were also, a greater percentage of them were, you can see the income differences here. Also something we found interesting was that those with mobility limitations reported 29% of them reported 11 more absences from school in the prior year compared with 14% in the rest of the sample. So in the results, in terms of receiving pediatric care only, we found that youth with mobility limitation were more likely than those with others, children with other special health care needs to report that their medical provider treated children only. So this is based on the whole sample and looking at the likelihood of those being seen for pediatric care only. The adjusted odds ratio on that is 1.28. So the differences aren't huge, but there is a significant difference there, 65% versus 59%. This slide shows the overall transition planning variable, which is from all three spheres of life, whether their criteria were met, and compares the youth with mobility limitation again to the whole rest of the sample. And we can see in terms of the advice that is being given, there's significant differences in all categories, except for discussing future health insurance need. But you can see the numbers here are pretty low. So of course, maybe if we had the age lower band of the age range higher, this number would start to come up. But in terms of the shifting to an adult provider, only 32% of youth with mobility limitations reported that their providers discussed this, compared to 44%. Of others with special health care needs. So It's, again, in terms of looking at mobility limitations versus others, the picture isn't that great. And even if you just look at other children's special health care needs, some of these numbers are pretty low, even though they're better than for those with mobility limitation. This bottom one is the, again, is kind of the overall, all components. And so you can see the odds ratios here in terms of the differences between the mobility limitation, less likely to receive the transition advice. So looking at just the youth with mobility limitation and transition planning, this first model, again, is the overall transition planning. So we can see that if the parent reports that the care that's being received is consistent with the components of medical home, the youth is 3.5 times more likely to have met the criteria for transition planning in general to the different spheres of life, work and healthcare, independence. And then in the second model, looking at the different medical home components, we can see that only two of them significantly predicted. Although the odds ratios here are some of the larger ones aren't significant just based on the characteristics of the sample in terms of the sample size and the variation. But having family centered care and having care coordination were the two components of medical home that predicted whether healthcare advice was given. And in this slide, you can just sort of see the raw percentages in terms of for youth with mobility limitation, with and without medical home, whether the doctor discussed future health care needs, shifting to an adult provider, or future health insurance needs. So even those who said they had a medical home, the numbers are still pretty low. And then, of course, even lower for those who don't have a medical home. So in summary, youth with mobility limitation and pediatric care are less likely to receive transition planning advice than other children with special health care needs. And we found that care in a medical home is associated with receipt of transition planning advice, which we would hope. The definition of medical home does not include, I'll show you some of the items, so it doesn't include specifically transition advice, but it includes addressing issues which transition advice would fall into. So you would hope that transition advice would be part of the components of medical home, but we found that that was not necessarily the case. And also in summary, for youth with mobility limitation, family-centered care and coordinated care is important for planning the transition from pediatric to adult health care. And interestingly, having a personal doctor or nurse or a usual source of care was not sufficient by itself for transition planning. So here you can get a sense for all the different items that go into the definition of medical home. Having a personal doctor or nurse is just, does the child have one person who the parent considers to be their personal doctor or nurse? Accessibility, can they get advice by the telephone? Can they get an appointment as soon as they need it for routine care? Do they have to wait less than 15 minutes during appointments? The family-centered aspect of the definition involves, does the personal doctor or nurse know the child? Do they talk with the parent about how the child is feeling? Do the doctors communicate well? And do they feel like they're getting the needed information, and also shared decision making? The comprehensiveness, could they find a personal doctor or nurse with a little or no problem? They get a referral to a specialist if they need it? Are they getting care that the parent or doctor believes necessary? And then finally, a coordination aspect of it is, this is really what this analysis was about, and are they getting the coordination and the advice and the information that they need to be able to find an adult provider once they leave their pediatric care. So in terms of what the next steps are to address this problem, I work with Children's Hospital in Seattle a lot, and it seems like every different clinic that we work with, they all address the same issue. And it seems like a large part of the problem is finding providers in the community who know specifically about the issue which the child has been, in the case that I'm familiar with in Children's, often Children's Hospitals, there's a team-oriented approach, different providers working in coordination, and then when the child goes into the community, everything kind of just falls apart. There's no coordination, and they sometimes can't even find a person or a doctor or a nurse who they feel really understands their condition, and will often talk about needing to educate the doctor about what their condition is, and kind of starting from square one, whereas when they were in the pediatric care, everything was really kind of coordinated and understood. So I have a grant proposal under review to do a national convenience sample survey of young adults with mobility limitation to get a better idea about what are the barriers, the structural and the process barriers to receiving the appropriate care in the adult health arena. So in terms of anything concrete, I'm kind of still sort of at a loss because I don't really totally understand what all the issues are. And with regard to the issue of there being providers in the community who understand the condition, I don't know. You know, maybe some sort of distance medicine will be necessary in some cases to get people at least the information that they need. But that's, we're really kind of at the beginning of trying to address this issue. Thank you.
Thank you to all of our speakers. We'll open up the floor for questions now. If you have a question, if you could please come to the microphone, or Steve will direct the microphone to you.
If you answer a question, try to come speak into this one also.
So I'm really thrilled that you collect the data in urban and rural areas. And so rural communities differ tremendously, and I'm not very familiar with the ones in and around the area you're serving, whether they're agricultural or growing and whatnot. But one of the things we'd love to talk about is Catherine Gibson, a colleague, was able to do some analysis of observations of 19 communities we observed, private businesses across Montana, and do some analysis that developed some interesting findings. So, for example, population growth, retail sales, home ownership, and median income are all related to the increased likelihood of accessibility in communities. Surprisingly, the prevalence of people with disabilities is negatively associated. We haven't quite figured that out. We think it may be a proxy for something like poverty or something like that. But there are potential strategies for beginning to answer some of those questions. Thank you. It's great. Looking forward to learning more.
I'll hog the microphone for a second, and Lisa and Nancy need to talk to Barbara Parklaw over there. She really needs her data.
Jean Hales here. Great to see the fruits of our work in live and in living color. So Nancy, two issues related to pediatric data,
mm-hmm.
and lab of tables and scales. What we found in the reality of our survey work, many of the hospitals that were mentioned yesterday, and UCSF and Brigham and Mass General and more, was that providers perceived the pediatric population as being able to be lifted onto the tables and lifted onto the scales and they don't like electrical cords in the exam rooms where the kids play with them. There's a total lack of recognition of the transition issue that is the adolescent population,
right,
who's still seeing the same provider until age 21. Maybe it's one less bad for the picture. So I think we might need to segment the population a little bit differently, because pediatrics, in our view, is to come down with our median term when it comes to looking at accessible equipment.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Hi, Susan Redman. I work for Title V in Florida, and in addition to the national data that we get on healthcare transition and all the aspects of medical home, we collect our own data. And I wonder, Dr. Edwards, if in Washington State, if you've worked with Title V, or if they're collecting any data on these issues that you're looking at.
Not that we're really aware of now. Do you work with Dr. Reese, or?
Yeah.
Oh, he's here. Yeah. No, we don't have anything. Unfortunately, we don't have anything comparable in Washington. No.
Thanks for my plug for data. It's for a federal committee that I'm working on to define medically underserved populations. So I'm not publishing it or anything. I'm just sharing it with the government committee so we can use it. But I wanted to talk a little bit about transition, and I'm wondering if you're involved with Dr. Sandy Bugatti, because there's a group called Physician Parent Caregivers that's concerned with transition. And I can give you the information. I got involved because I have, as people who know me, I have 6 kids with disabilities, and I've taught them all. One of the things I think we need to add to the model is empowerment. So my kids go into the doctor, and they all have their own medical histories with them. They can recite them from memory, which is easy. My son, who's on the autism spectrum, when he goes into a doctor, he says, "I'm on the autism spectrum. I have a distorted sense of pain. My mom says if I tell you something hurts, it could be really serious, and you should investigate it seriously." So I think that model advocacy. I also think there's a problem when you have a 25-year-old with a congenital heart problem who has to still see a pediatric cardiologist because none of the adult physician, cardiologists know what to do with her.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a real need for empowerment and some, I don't know if it's a case manager model, but there's some model somewhere to help these kids transition, because half the time they walk in and say, "I've got these 5 or 6 conditions," and the doctor looks at them and says, "Oh."
Yeah.
Start.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because that's something where we can start, right away, and hopefully the system will, will become improved over time. But yes, people can, take control themselves if they can. Yeah.
That's Kurt Johnson at the University of Washington. Todd, what did you drew your sample from kids that maxed out at 18 years old in the survey?
It was 17.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, since, we've also looked at the kids that come out of Children's, and they tend to hold them until they're 21 or 22.
Yeah.
Because many of them are IEPs, and they don't actually exit the school system. So they stay in those wraparound services, and I wonder if maybe you didn't catch some of that, or at least some of the more excruciating failure that happens just because you cut the draw too early.
Yeah, I think my colleague Janice Bell actually was much more familiar with this survey. She's in maternal and child health. I think it basically ends there. Yeah. So that's really what we're going to be doing in this grant, if we get it funded, is taking the questions from the national service for children with special health care needs and adapting them to self-report, and hopefully to be able to continue the data source across that age range that we're interested in. So, yeah.
Hi, Megan Stephanie Phipps, and I'm relatively new to the children with special health care needs community and working in that research area. And I have a question, since there's so many experts in the room, in terms of defining children with special health care needs. I know you did it as, with a survey and a question, but in terms of how people are identifying these children in practices using diagnostic codes, if anyone has suggestions for me afterwards on how to identify them using some type of rubric, please come see me. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Linda Longville. I'm from UMass Medical School. And my question is for Lisa, although Nancy may want to chime in also as Paige. since you're working with Nancy June, I imagine that you know the answer to this question, but I wondered if any kind of questions about a provider's experience with patients with disabilities and any training in cultural competence or related kinds of things pertaining to people with disabilities could be incorporated into your survey in some way, or if there's any discussion of that.
You're going to have to sit here. We've considered doing surveys of our providers and asking them those questions, but based on other health plans' experience doing just that, we realized that a self-report asking providers what their experience is and what their expertise is would not really tell us what we wanted. We also had concerns that providers would not want to self-identify as experts in serving people with certain disabilities, because then they might open the floodgates, to use their terms, to their practice being flooded with a lot of complicated, expensive people. So, for those two, it's real. I mean, this is fact. I know it doesn't sound good to hear, but it's true. So we've been hesitant to do that kind of self-reported survey. We have done some provider education around disability issues, where we've had conferences attended by medical assistants, nurses, physicians, and office staff, where we talk about cultural competence and with disability as a culture, and improving their competency to serve people who have low vision, who have hearing loss, who have mobility limitations. So we've done that many times, but as I mentioned before, we have this massive provider network, and trying to reach all them is difficult, and getting them to come to an event is difficult. Our state currently has a contract with June and her colleagues to develop a more intense provider education, given that California's Medicaid program is undergoing a significant change right now, and will be requiring most seniors and people with disabilities who have Medicaid to join a Medicaid health plan. So there are some additional efforts underway to improve providers' competency, but just the scale is so huge. We don't have the magic bullet to reach out to them yet, but we're working on some of these efforts. Yeah, and yes,
I had one comment and then one question. My comment is for the woman who did the study on people getting pap smears and gynecological exams. I just think that that was actually great work, and actually very sad for me to even hear a comment that nobody bothers to tell people why they're having surgery. My second comment has to do, again, with surveying physicians about adapting their offices to meet the needs of people with special health conditions. And I want to know, on the flip side, have you surveyed patients using, I believe there was a CAPS module that was developed a while back, but what are you hearing from patients about the improvements that are made to the offices and what should be made? Those are things.
Before I answer your question, I just wanted to make one more comment related back to what Linda had asked. The study I had on the slide by Sanchez was really interesting, because they first called the provider's office and asked them, do you have these different characteristics of accessibility? And they talked to the office manager, and the office manager said, yes, we can do this, and yes, we can do that, and so on and so forth. And then they followed up with an on-site review and found a big difference between what the office manager said and what they actually observed, which is to sort of reinforce what Lisa was saying, that I'm not sure where we get with self-report necessarily, because there was fairly significant differences. I haven't actually looked at the CAPS data, but there are a number of studies where patients have talked about their experiences. I don't I haven't seen anything, sort of large national quantitative that has done that. And that was actually one of the tasks that I was doing as part of the National Council on Disability Project, Current State of Healthcare for People with Disabilities, was to look to see what was going on in these data. And they were, at the time, developing the CAHPS questions. But, you know, part of it is it's voluntary whether, you know, a subunit wants to use it. So, to my knowledge right now, we don't have anything more than these small qualitative studies on that issue.
So, a question here. I thought this is really, really great work, especially the access and transition, just these are really major issues, but I'd like to see a lot of this expanded toward more kind of coverage of neurological developmental disabilities, which sometimes get left out in the shuffle, I think, in terms of accessibility, in terms of communication needs. A lot of people with neurological developmental intellectual disabilities, things of cognitive nature, can walk in and because of the fact their disability is not as evident or because of the fact there's lack of understanding, there's difficulty of accessing providers. And one area that some colleagues of mine have been part of is it's called the Academic Autistic Spectrum Partnership in Research and Education. It's a CBPR, so community-based participatory research project that is working with autistic adults on barriers to healthcare access usage. They're also involved with some other projects as well. That's one of the things they're looking at, and it seems to be one of the few out there that are actually looking at barriers around the neurological disability population group, because often not just important to be looking at physical access, kind of say barriers, but I think also things around communication, attitudes, et cetera, around neurological disabilities is something that I'd like to see expanded across these surveys. But really, really great work that you all.